listening to Where Talk on 89.3 KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle. Reminder that NPR and KPECC are providing coverage all this week on the expected House action to move forward with impeachment of President Trump. There could be a vote tomorrow on an effort to get Vice President Mike Pence to invoke the 25th Amendment, along with other cabinet members, to declare the president unable to conduct the duties of the office of the presidency. And it could be Wednesday that we have an actual impeachment vote in the House of Representatives. So we'll keep you up to date on Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and of course throughout the day in our local programming here on KPECC. But right now, we turn our attention to the latest in COVID-19 news. Joining me from UC Davis Children's Hospital, Chief of Pediatric Infectious Diseases and Professor of Medicine at UC Davis, Dr. Dean Blumberg. Dr. Blumberg, thank you for being with us this morning and hope you had a good weekend.
Yeah, I did have a good weekend. Thank you, Larry. How about you?
It was very nice. Nice break. Thank you very much. So you've had both of your vaccine shots now?
Yeah, I've had both vaccine doses. I had my second dose last week on Wednesday, and I feel fine. I feel fine today.
Great. Did you have, with your second shot, any sort of a negative reaction?
I did. It was worse than the first shot. The second shot, I did have a sore arm, which was similar to the first one. But I also felt a little bit more tired and a mild headache, which I don't usually get. That just lasted about a day, and then I improved. But you know, several of my colleagues were hit hard with the second dose, some with high fever, like over 101, some of them with terrible headaches, and some of them who were so tired just felt wiped out by it that they had to stay in bed all day.
And what's the theory as to why the second injection hit so much harder than the first?
You know, I don't know. I mean, it seems to be an immunologic reaction, so that there's more inflammation associated with the second immunization compared to the first. And it seems to be more common to have the severe reactions in those who are younger than those who are older. And so those who are older do have less robust immune responses in general. And so it does seem to be related to the immune response, the general overall inflammation.
And just clarify, the second dose is identical, the composition of that, to the first dose that's given?
Yeah, absolutely. So the second dose is recommended to be exactly the same as the first dose. So if you get the Pfizer vaccine, the first dose, you get the Pfizer vaccine, the second dose, and same with Moderna. So they're not mixing and matching, and the actual dosage is exactly the same.
Given the negative result that some of your colleagues had, where they felt ill for a period of time after the second injection, is it your sense that that has in any way discouraged people at UC Davis Medical to be vaccinated?
Well, this is anecdotal and not scientific data, but what I've heard from people is they've gotten it, they've had that, they weren't happy that they were wiped out for a day, but they're happy to have presumptive immunity. And so I haven't heard anybody who's regretted getting vaccinated, and almost everybody I've talked to has been extraordinarily enthusiastic about being able to have the privilege to be immunized and to be protected.
So you haven't had the kind of reluctance, it sounds like, that some hospitals have had. There's some in the Inland Empire here in Southern California that have had, at least initially, and that might have changed, up to half of their eligible personnel turned down the vaccine.
Yeah, and I can understand that to a point. I mean, that wasn't my opinion, but you know, the vaccine was developed with, you know, unprecedented rapidity, and it does utilize a novel technology that has not been in widespread use before. So of course, people are going to be reluctant to be immunized. Some people are. You know, and if they're hesitant, there's a lot of people who aren't going to be early adopters, and they might wait for more experience. and more published experience. And for them, you know, that's fine. They shouldn't be pushed. They shouldn't be pressured. And hopefully, eventually, they will be comfortable with the experience that people are having, and they will look at the data and then choose to be vaccinated at a later time.
Dr. Dean Blumberg, UC Davis Children's Hospital, with us. We have questions for Dr. Blumberg. We're at 866-893-KPECC. Also, the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Tweet at AirTalk or post on the AirTalk Facebook page. Early on with the distribution of the vaccine at hospitals, there were a couple cases I was reading about where the news accounts were highly critical of the hospitals for giving the leftover doses to family members of people in leadership positions, the hospital and the like. So now it appears that hospitals are, you know, if they have more vaccine than people eligible to receive it, according to state guidelines, that there are some doses being destroyed. And of course, they're being criticized for that. So, Dr. Blumberg, your thoughts on what is the appropriate thing for health facilities to do when they have extra doses?
Well, I certainly wouldn't recommend destroying the vaccine, and I think it's a really bad look to give people who are in perceived positions of privilege to get the vaccine and to jump the line. So I think both of those approaches are not preferred. And as we learn more about the vaccine distribution and the availability, and that we don't know exactly how many doses we have when we start a vaccine clinic, since the vials are overfilled and you may get more doses out of those than it's labeled for. So I think the appropriate response to that is to have a clear priority list and to say this is the clinic that we're having that we're going to vaccinate those on our priority list. And if we have vaccine left over, we've got a second priority list that others may be vaccinated that aren't in our top priority. So the CDC is very clear on this with their vaccination phases, and they say that it's not necessary to vaccinate all individuals in one phase before initiating the next phase, and the phases may overlap. So you may, for example, immunize patients. The highest priority among healthcare workers is those who are facing patients. But you may also then, if you have leftover doses, vaccinate laboratory workers or technicians or others who may not be at risk from contracting the virus due to being in contact with patients. But you got to have those lab workers in order to hospital run.
Or like a hospital president. There are people that are critical that hospital president. But if your hospital president goes down with COVID in the midst of a crisis like this, that's not a good thing either.
Right. I mean, I think it's easy to target administrators. We all, you know, sometimes we don't know what they're doing, and we think there's just too much fat at the top and all, and that they should be cut. But yeah, hospital administrators make sure that we have all the supplies we have all the personnel we have, that the policies are in place. So they're critical to the running of the hospital. So we need leadership. We need hospital leadership. So the example, they would be appropriate to be called if there's extra doses of vaccine.
We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. JSK writes on the page, is the greater reaction with the second injection of the vaccine an indicator of the body's increased immune response to the coronavirus?
Yeah, you know, I've heard that, and I've also heard that even with the first dose, that if people have a more severe reaction, like their arm hurts for longer, that indicates that they have a more robust immune response to somebody whose arm doesn't hurt. And I've heard that anecdotally, but I have not seen any evidence to that effect.
866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Joaquin in the Burbs writes on the page, California, quote, relaxed criteria, and seniors in phase 1B still aren't expected to get vaccines until February. Joaquin, I know that there are some age 75 and older who are able to make appointments and are expected to get vaccines rather soon. But one of the things I think is very frustrating, Dr. Blumberg, is that it just seems like it's so hit and miss that people are finding it very difficult to get information on when they're going to be able to be vaccinated, where that's going to happen. It's just there's a real lack of messaging.
Yeah, there is. And you know, it is frustrating. And there's also, you know, the issues that we've heard from other states that in Texas and Florida, for example, that they've really just opened it up to immunization and haven't prioritized as closely. And I think that comes from, you know, the lack of federal leadership in this area. So we know that the feds have taken a step back and the CDC has been relatively sidelined over the past few years. And so hopefully, you know, over the coming weeks, the CDC will again regain their leadership role and be able to have more guidance. One of the issues and challenges that we've all had is we're not sure how many vaccine doses are on the way. And then it's difficult to know, should we contact patients and tell them, you know, we've got vaccine available for you, or when this might be available. But we are entering that transition now between phase 1A, which is healthcare personnel and long-term care facility residents, and phase 1B, which is persons greater than or equal to 75 years of age and frontline essential workers. So there is a transition right now.
Joe asks, who manages inventory and expiry information? It should be possible to have open sessions for anything that would otherwise go unused. Joe, that would be the rational way to deal with it. Dr. Blumberg, you know, why has this been challenging?
Yeah, so the state has an idea of the vaccine that they're going to receive in any given week, but that may be modified. And then the state has a distribution plan to individual hospitals. And then the hospitals, once they get the vaccine, or the pharmacies, they get the vaccine, then they're in charge of distributing it, for example, to different sites or clinics and making sure that the vaccine doses don't expire. And they do expire about you know, once you take them out of their frozen state, they're stable in the refrigerator for up to 5 days. So they need to be careful how they manage all that.
And I think it's frustrating for so many people, Dr. Blumberg, to see, you know, the state pointing the finger at the feds pointing back to the state saying, you know, you're the ones who've got the state health agencies to carry this out. You know what the needs are. You know, you handle it. And it's frustrating, I think, for people to look at you know, these two parts of government, each of whom not just, you know, grabbing hold of the ball and doing something about it.
Well, I can just speak from my experience, which is thinking about like in 2009 with H1N1, and when the influenza H1N1 vaccine was rolled out, it was extraordinarily coordinated between the feds and at the state level on several aspects. It wasn't just vaccine distribution, but it was planning for vaccination clinics, the priorities, the supplies, the scheduling. All that was coordinated between the feds and the state, and that's not the case with this vaccine rollout. That has not been coordinated. The federal support hasn't been there for the states. So I think there is a lot that's lacking.
866-893-KPECC. Kathleen in Long Beach says, as a senior, I'm struggling with a lot of people who have reservations about vaccinations. For healthcare staff not taking the vaccine, can they be asked to stay home instead of working with patients? Kathleen, you know, last week we talked about the ethical issues that this raises. The problem is when you've got FDA approval for emergency use. This is not approved, you know, as a typical medication or vaccine would be after years of study. Then, you know, would you want to actually mandate something that's still experimental for people to take to be able to work? What do you think, Dr. Blumberg?
Yeah, I agree with you. I think you don't want to jam something down people's throats when they're not comfortable with it. We've already seen the backlash. We've had other mandatory immunization policies, and these are with the other ones were with vaccines that have been around for years, and we've got tons of experience with knowing that they are safe and effective. So since these are so new, I'd be reluctant to have any mandate in place until we have more experience with them. think it's appropriate for them to be available on a voluntary basis at the present time. I don't know of any hospital that's mandating them at the present time. And then later on, we can have that discussion, maybe in 6 months or a year or longer, however long it takes for us to gain the experience and for people to be comfortable with this. We've seen this with other vaccine mandates for children for school immunization requirements. We saw the backlash that occurred with the HPV vaccine, that as soon as those vaccines came out, several states mandated them for school, and nobody was comfortable with that. And so that really set HPV vaccine efforts back, and that resulted in people getting HPV, and they will get cancer for that.
So, and that wasn't under emergency authorization.
You're exactly right. That was following the standard FDA process. So yes, I'd be reluctant to go there with this vaccine at the present time.
866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Let's see. We have Nylon in Redondo Beach. Has any data been collected on individuals who had COVID in the past and received their second vaccine shot, with people experiencing more side effects with the second injection? Nylon says, I wonder what kind of side effects people who were positive once before might be experiencing.
Yeah, with both the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccine trials, some of the study participants had prior infection with COVID-19 and were immunized, and they did not find any increased frequency of adverse effects following immunization in those who had previous infection with COVID-19 versus those who did not have previous infection.
We'll continue with Dr. Dean Blumberg, UC Davis Children's Hospital, pediatric infectious disease specialist and professor of medicine at UC Davis Medical Center in the School of Medicine. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. We'll talk with Dr. Blumberg about Curative's tests. That company's tests, which have been heavily used in Los Angeles, have been warned about by the FDA for having a high rate of false negatives. We'll talk about when it's appropriate to use those tests and when not, when we come back in 1 minute. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Coming up, we'll talk about a brand new LA Studios podcast, Norco 80, which looks at a terrible shootout in the streets of that Riverside County city in 1980, and the changes that that brought in the arming of police as a result of sheriff's deputies being heavily outgunned during that bank robbery in Norco. Norco 80, the podcast we'll be talking about later this hour on Air Talk. Right now, we're talking about COVID-19 at 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Dr. Dean Blumberg, UC Davis Children's Hospital, with us. The FDA put out a renewed warning about Curative's COVID-19 tests because of a high rate of false negatives. Los Angeles had been using that test quite heavily. Dr. Blumberg, what are the limits of that test, and when is it appropriate to use it?
Yeah, it's my understanding that that test is still accurate and that the FDA warning came out because the test was being used inappropriately. And the main issue was there were false negatives, so people may have had COVID and the test may have come back negative. And that was likely the result of inadequate sampling. So if you don't get a good sample, if you don't get enough viral genome, then the test may be negative. And anecdotally, what we heard were some patients were collecting the swabs themselves, and that's not how this test is designed. That the swabs should be collected from a trained healthcare provider, and to assure that an adequate specimen is obtained.
And some of these are done at home with the same principle. I don't know whether it's Curatives or other companies, but many people have been testing at home doing that. So you're saying that that's not particularly effective because the individual doesn't necessarily know how to gather the specimen correctly?
Specifically not with the curative test. So there are other tests that are designed for self-collection at home, but not the curative test isn't designed that way.
All right. And one of our producers said she took a curative test last week at a drive-through test center. She took the swab herself and said, she's in the car and being waved along by workers at a very, fast clip. So it sounds like that's kind of the way that it was being done here, not being heavily overseen. Is it just a matter that there's just not enough, saliva or what's collected for the sample?
Exactly. Yeah. So the swab isn't done correctly. So some of the swabs are the deep nasopharyngeal swabs that go away in the back of the throat. Others are the mid-turbinate swabs, and then some are saliva samples. But it needs to be collected appropriately. If the sample is not a good one, then of course you may not get enough of the virus in there, and then the test may be negative.
Martha in Studio City was wondering about taking the vaccine. She'd recently had surgery. Is there any reason why she should avoid it?
No, if she's recovered from surgery and is able to go to a vaccine clinic, then there's no reason. That's not a contraindication to immunization.
866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Sally in Claremont says she's 68, has a number of different underlying conditions, and wondering what your advice is. Has there been enough study on people who have multiple underlying conditions?
So people with underlying conditions were part of the studies that were reported by Moderna and Pfizer. So they have been studied, and no difference in immune response was found with those with pre-existing conditions. Now, there's some conditions that were exclusions from the studies, and that included things like pregnancy or autoimmune diseases. So some of those have not been studied, but patients with heart disease, renal disease, and others were included.
866-893-KPECC. Or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Let us know any of the questions that you have about COVID-19 vaccines. Amina writes, I'm seeing a lot of privileged young people on Facebook posting their vaccination photos, musicians and Instagram influencers. One friend my age who works at the VA with a desk job, no contact with patients, got vaccinated last week, said the shots were distributed to anyone who wanted one. Seems really unfair to me. That's Amina writing on the AirTalk page. Dr. Blumberg.
Yeah, I mean, I can see that, too. And so I'm not sure about the VA worker. I mean, they're working in a healthcare environment, so they may be considered an essential worker. So I could see that. You know, for musicians and others, I mean, I value music, but
yes.
CDC not classify them as essential workers. Teachers are included in some of the phases, but maybe if they were a music teacher, I'm not sure.
Yeah, that's a good point, because if there are teachers in some regions that are starting to get vaccination, I'm not aware of that in Los Angeles County, but that certainly is possible. 866-893-KPECC. Nancy in Tarzana says, I'm 72 years old. Through CalVax.org, I've been able to get a vaccine for an appointment at a hospital. I'd like to know if it's legitimate because it didn't ask about my age requirements.
Yeah, I'm not sure about that. Right now, as far as I'm aware, in California, we're transitioning from phase 1A to phase 1B. Phase 1B is frontline essential workers and those 75 years old and older. So if she's, I think you said 72.
Yeah.
That's phase 1C. So I'm not sure about the organization and how they're interpreting these priority groups.
All right. I want to thank you so much, Dr. Blumberg, to be with us. Oh, I have one quick question for you. I forgot to ask. Indonesia, I understand, is taking an approach where they're vaccinating young employed people first because the idea is to get their economy up and running. And I guess their thought is that older people can take care of themselves somehow. But your thoughts about that approach of doing, in a sense, the opposite of what we're doing here?
Yeah, it's a really interesting approach. And one of the issues is that we know that the rate of infection is higher in younger people, and that's likely because they are out and about more. So they're not leading as social distanced a lifestyle. So if you control infection in those people, maybe that's best for the whole community because that decreases risks for those who are older and more vulnerable. It's an interesting thought. I'd rather have the approach that the U.S. is taking with vaccinating those who are most vulnerable to severe illness as well as essential workers. But it'd be interesting to see the effect of that program.
Thank you, Dr. Blumberg, as always. We so appreciate your time. You've been an invaluable member of our core of medical experts who've come on each day with us during this pandemic. We really appreciate it.
Great. Thank you, and stay safe, Larry.
Thank you so much. Looking forward to get my vaccine sometime in the months ahead. You're listening to AIR Talk on 89.3 KPECC or the KPECC app. So good to have you with us on AIR Talk.